This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another.
Welcome back, hopefully, back to Practical for Your Practice. I am Dr. Jenna Ermold, one of your hosts, and thrilled to be here with my podcast bestie, one of my podcast besties, Corinne Lefkowitz. How's it going,
Hello,
Corinne?
Jenna. Hi, I'm excited to be considered one of your podcast besties since you only have two. I'm glad to be one of them.
You caught that, did you?
Yeah. I did catch that, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, I was trying to be nice, but speaking of besties, Corinne, I have been really working hard to get our guest on our podcast today. She is very busy. She has a lot going on, and she is by far one of my all-time work and outside of work besties, the wonderful Dr. Patricia Watson, our colleague from the National Center for PTSD, who I guess I've known you. I was trying to think when that all started. I feel like I've known you for definitely over 10 years, maybe a little bit more. But anyway, today we have Dr. Patricia Watson. Welcome to our Practical for Your Practice podcast. And can you just tell our listeners just a little thumbnail sketch of who you are and what you do?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Jenna. It's very nice to be here with both of you. I am a psychologist at the National Center for PTSD. I've been there since 1998. Prior to that, I was a clinical psychologist in the Navy working with adults for 4 years and then went back and got a postdoctoral fellowship in pediatric psychology and worked with children and families for 4 years. So starting at the National Center for PTSD, I really had a passion for trying to digest research and distill it down into very practical, usable strategies for people. Because when I was a clinician in the Navy, I was so busy, I never had a chance to do that.
Yeah. You are like a natural for our podcast, because that is, you've really described what we aim to do, even on this podcast, just to take good quality information and distill it into something usable by our providers. So we're so happy to have you here.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here with both of you.
Well, and I feel like you like started to tiptoe towards the next thing that we're wondering. But you know, if you've been listening throughout the season, our sort of theme, if you will, this season is what's your why? We're really interested in the, I think we called them like provider superhero
origin stories.
Yeah. So like, what is your psychologist origin story? Not all the way back, please. But, you know, what's your why? Why do you do, or why do you continue to pursue the work that you do? And the topic that we're going to talk about today, which I probably should introduce, is stress first aid, which Patricia is very invested in, does a lot of work in. So what's your why? Can you give us like a little bit of a story of how you got to where you are?
Yes. So Jenna, when I was 2 years old, I'm just kidding. But really, when I was really young, I was a very curious child and always wondered, why are people so mean to each other? I remember asking my mom that. And I also had very vivid dreams. So I was always interested in psychology. I was particularly interested in how people got through difficult times. I was always interested in prevention. And I, you know, started out actually in college as an art major, but then I switched to psychology because I had a professor who said, I think you'd be good at this. So,
from that part of your background, the art side.
Yeah.
You're very creative.
They go together in a lot of different ways. So I guess my why has always been wanting to understand the human condition in general and try to figure out ways to alleviate some of the difficulties that people go through is one of the reasons why I went into child psychology in the first place when I was in the Navy, because I thought, well, if we could catch things early, then maybe we could prevent some of the damage that's done by early trauma and that kind of thing. I had worked with in the Navy. My dissertation was about how childhood trauma might affect people's ability to handle stress in the military. So I realized that what we were seeing from the data was that the more intense the trauma was in childhood, the harder it was for them to handle some of the stress. And I did not want to publish that study. We never did because, in part, I didn't want to have the military say, oh, well, we should screen those people out. Because
Oh, wow, yeah.
what I was seeing was that people, in many ways, were coming into the military to make a better life for themselves. And many of the ones that had trauma backgrounds were actually excelling in the military. They had already learned how to, deal with so many things in life. So they were doing really well. And I never wanted anybody to take a swath of our research and use it to cut people out of that. So, yeah, I've always been interested in prevention. One of the things that was particularly hard for me working with children was that I realized fairly early on that it wasn't really about working with children. It was about trying to help the parents shape the environment. And the parents were often extremely busy and they were too tired to do the things that I thought would be helpful for the children. So it ended up taking a toll on me. It really took a toll on me. That was the reason I stepped out of that job and took a break from it.
That's really funny. That is exactly why I pivoted from working with children. I absolutely thought I wanted to do children exclusively, loved adolescents especially. And then it was really frustrating. There was some frustrating aspects to that. So hats off to all of you out there who work with children.
I agree. I agree. It's a really
Takes a
important
special
job.
breed. That's a wild origin story for a few reasons. One, you've given me so much that I like now I just want to make this a much longer podcast episode or multiple because there's so many interesting things to talk about. Two, fascinating that, you didn't start in the same place that you ended up. And that's true of all of our origin stories as or for most of us that we've been talking about all season. So that's really interesting. But yes, I know we're here to talk about stress first aid. So I will rein it in and focus on what we're supposed to focus on. Good job, Corinne.
Thanks. Maybe we can start by you just kind of sharing with folks what stress first aid is for those of us who've not heard about it before.
Sure. So I'll start with another origin story, which is the origin of the model. So when I first came into the National Center, I was assigned to work on post-disaster interventions, right? We were working on a interagency agreement with a Substance Abuse Mental Health Association on helping them to look at what they tried to do after disasters and see if it would fit with the research. So we developed a few different models that are still being used after disasters today, a psychological first aid model that we developed with the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, and a follow-on to that called Skills for Psychological Recovery, which also was developed with National Child Traumatic Stress Network. And as a part of that, SAMHSA came to us in the middle of all of that and said, look, we would like to pull together an expert panel. That was something that we had been doing because we realized there was only so much you could gain from the research. It's very hard to do post-disaster research. So we were conducting expert panels all along the way where we would bring researchers and people who'd been on the ground who had lessons learned together, and we would ask them key questions. What would you recommend to do this and that? And so in the middle of all that, SAMHSA said, we'd like to pull another expert panel together to talk about what you do in situations of ongoing threat, ongoing stress, and adversity, because most of our models were post-event models, and they were dealing with some situations that lasted for months. So we gathered about 50 people from all around the world who were coming together for an international panel, an international conference. We asked them to stay an extra day, and it was again a combination of researchers and people who'd been on the ground in lots of different situations. And we presented the research that we gathered about this topic to them, and then we asked them to help us think through what can we recommend to people that have been in situations like this. So for me, the stress first aid model, in many ways, is an homage to all of those people who came, because I really respect them a lot. I really love the people that were at that panel, and they put a lot into thinking this through. And what we ended up distilling down, thanks to Stephen Hopfall, who's brilliant at distilling things down, he was the ended up being the first author on a paper we published about this. We ended up coming up with five what we called essential elements that seem to be related to people doing better after situations of adversity, many different kinds. And so those five elements are really simple. So whenever I give a training, I always tell people, if you don't remember anything else about this training, just remember that if you or your family or your friends or people you're working with are in a difficult situation and it's an extended period, we know that there are five things that seem to be helpful. One is getting people to move in the direction of a greater sense of psychological safety, right? All of us know that when you're in the middle of really threatening situations, you kind of shut down. It's hard to think, it's hard to make decisions. Your body kind of creates biochemicals that make it hard to function. So if you can move in the direction of feeling more safe, even if it's not absolute safety, that's a good step, right? Calming strategies is another one. People who tend to be able to self-calm or be with others who can calm them. A lot of our treatment models, our evidence-based treatment models, are organized around teaching people those types of skills. That's another important element. The third one is social support and good social connection, because that seems to be one of the most protective factors. If you have good friends, good family members, people you can come together with, it's very, very protective. And also staying away from influences that might not be so helpful. You know, that's another important part of that. The fourth element is self-efficacy, which is kind of a fancy term, which means people feel like they have the ability, the skills, or the resources to get through this. And we all know people that have had difficult childhoods who have had, you know, the resilience researchers will say there are two different ways that you can categorize resilience. One is that there's a certain subset of people that have a genetic kind of desire to master whatever comes their way. And those are small, that's a small subset of the population. More commonly, you have people in your life as a child who will be there to tell you, you can do this. I know you can do this, or here's how you can do this. It could be a teacher, a coach, an auntie, whoever it is. There's people around you that point out your strengths and help you feel better about getting through things. So self-efficacy is really important as well. And then the last one is hope. And hope is a broad term, but it's kind of maps onto optimism. We all know people who are naturally optimistic and vice versa, those who are naturally, like we call them Eeyores or Debbie Downers. You know, they just look at the negative side of things. But if you can cultivate optimism, gratitude, faith, religious faith is one thing that contributes to this. Having like strong philosophical codes that you live by, those things seem to come together and give people hope. So safety, calming, connectedness, self-efficacy, and hope are the five essential elements. And the stress first aid model was developed with those as the basis. It was originally developed for military settings. Navy and Marine Corps asked us to give them some trainings on trauma and prevention. And originally, I thought it was going to be psychological first aid. But when we got there, they said, no, we'd like to develop our own model. We don't like the word psychological because it increases stigma. We want it to be about stress, and stress can injure people. So they had already created what they called the stress continuum model, which is a way to think about levels of stress that people experience. They did that also to reduce stigma. And the goal was to say, you know, it's not that you're either in the green zone, which is you're fully functioning, or something's wrong with you. It's that you can be in the green zone, but the next day you can go into the yellow zone because of transient stressors. And then you can go into the orange zone because of a combination of more significant stressors. And they identified trauma, loss, moral injury, and wear and tear, which is too much yellow zone stress. And then you may go into the red zone, which is more like the diagnostic category of stress. They wanted to have people to have like a simple way to talk about levels of stress, and they wanted to have a way to reduce stigma. And so they had already developed that, and they turned to us and said, we know about this article about the five essential elements. Can you help create a model that maps onto this stress continuum, where we can particularly help people who've gone into the orange zone to mitigate their stress early on with peer support, because we know, all of us know, that a lot of people are faced with trauma and loss and things like that, but they never make it to a therapist's office, right? I
Right.
mean, we all see the benefit of evidence-based treatment, but a vast majority of people, when you look at the treatment studies, the average amount of time somebody will show up to a therapist's office is about 10 years from the time of trauma, and that's just average.
Right.
So they wanted a model where people could turn towards each other instead of turning away when they're experiencing too much stress. So that's how we brought this kind of five essential elements and created the model.
And that actually, so first of all, that was a fantastic. I've heard you talk about this many times, but I really loved how you just captured that, because it's a lot to capture succinctly
Is.
and make meaning of. But that's, I think the model is very user friendly in that regard. But you know, when we're talking about who, you know, what situations this is most effective, it sounds like situations in which there's ongoing stress, kind of maybe no end in sight. But like, who should become versed in this? What kinds of groups do you work with to get good at or be aware of, utilize this type of intervention or way of being? Is it an
The,
intervention? What do we call it? It's a,
we don't call it an
yeah,
official, we call it a model.
a
And
model. Okay.
we do that in part because intervention sounds too clinical, and we're trying to make it really
Right.
user friendly. It's also a really flexible model where we're not telling people how to reduce stress. We're just telling them these are the important elements to keep in mind when you're putting, yourself in a place where you want to help another person or use this model for self-care. You get to decide how you calm yourself or how you calm a coworker, because we don't want to come in and say you have to do it this way, because we know that will fail. People have to pick what works best for them. But we do tell them, don't forget, like when you're in the middle of stress, we know these things are helpful. So they tend to fall away when we're under too much stress, when we're too busy. All of us don't reach out to our friends as frequently when we're under a lot of stress, right? It's like, oh, I can do that later. I've got to focus on this. And yet the model would say, even if you could find a little way to reach out to a friend or to calm yourself, just don't put those things so far back. Bring them forward as much as you can
Right.
and do it in the way that works best for you. So I would say, I can't even remember the question now,
Well,
but
it was, you know, what who should
oh,
become
who do
well
we do
versed in it,
this?
but the only just wanting to, I think what you just said is so important, just how adaptable this is. I mean, for different cultures, for different groups of people, for different types of stressors. I'm always so impressed by that. And so it may not even be as important. I was just sort of,
No, I think it's
yeah.
actually a good question, because it was originally developed for military, but we've made versions of it for basically high stress jobs. So we started with military, then we moved to fire and EMS, emergency medical. Then we made a version for law enforcement, made a version for probation officers. We're in the middle of making a version for harm reduction workers who help peer support with people with substance use issues. We also have a version for healthcare workers that we further developed during the pandemic. We
Yeah,
had this
during
moment,
COVID, right?
yeah, during
Yeah.
COVID, we had a moment where we were like, okay, what should we be recommending to people? And I was thinking, okay, psychological first aid, I don't know. And then I thought, the stress first aid model really maps onto COVID, because we have no
Yeah.
idea how long this is going to last. So that's on the National Center for PTSD website. We created a stress first aid toolkit that has manuals and workbooks and slide sets. One of the things I love about this model, it was developed in the public domain. So anyone can come to our website and get the materials and train other people and use the materials however you want. You can also, if you need a trainer, can reach out to us, but it's meant to be a model that can be circulated pretty widely. I would say anyone who's in ongoing stress could use it. I wrote an article for mental health clinicians for International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies at the beginning of the pandemic, because my experience and some of the articles we've written since were that mental health professionals were under a lot of stress during the pandemic, during COVID, because they were being called upon to do things virtually. It can be really, really challenging for people to work virtually when you're used to sitting with a person. So I would say anyone who's under a lot of stress, you could use it with your family and friends if you want. So.
I really appreciate how you made some distinctions between, first of all, the different versions of the model and how they've evolved over time. And I've also appreciated that you've started to mention some of the resources that are available. And we're absolutely going to come back to that because we want to make those accessible to our listeners as well. But before we go there, I personally have not had much, I have not had any experience with stress first aid. I have very little experience with psychological first aid. About 15 years ago, I guess it was at this point that I was able to reach out to survivors of a couple of earthquakes that had taken place in China and delivering the psychological first aid model. And I found it so, even though it was so long ago, it's an experience that stuck with me. I think partly because of the reason that you mentioned earlier that in my regular practice, I'm used to seeing people who've experienced a trauma 10 years ago or 40 years ago or 15 years ago and have recovered to or have started to recover, have it's no longer happening anymore. The event isn't happening anymore, as opposed to responding in the moment when the crisis is still ongoing. And at least for myself, it felt really hard to do that. And it felt overwhelming and I felt a little bit hopeless at times. And so I wonder, first of all, was my experience normal? Is that something that you've seen in providers? And if so, what do you do about that as a provider who's trying to respond, who's trying to help somebody with their own stress, but feeling overwhelmed by it?
I love that question. I think that's what I've seen over the years because I've trained a lot of people in psychological first aid as well as stress first aid. And when you're talking about acute stress that's as chaotic and destabilizing as a disaster, mental health professionals, particularly really well-trained mental health professionals, are actually one of the hardest groups to train in psychological first aid because they're so used to the context of people coming in. There's
Right.
a, there's an implicit, there's a contract when somebody comes to you for help, right? They're also usually a bit of a step to remove from the acute crisis phase. In order to get to a mental health professional, they have to have the wherewithal and the resources to gather themselves and get to you, right?
Yes.
You, in contrast, when you're coming into a chaotic environment, like a post-disaster environment, there's no contract. You might be meeting them at a shelter or doing outreach where you're coming to them, right? And their life is in so much chaos that actually all these wonderful tools we have in evidence-based psychotherapies aren't appropriate for that particular context. So it can be really hard as a mental health professional who knows how well these things work to rein it in and be like, okay, this isn't the right time and place for this. Because you know they work, but it's not the right time. So that's one of the things I like about these five elements because the goal is to really be more coming from an instinctive place of if I was in crisis, what would be helpful? One of my favorite colleagues, Richard Gist, who works in fire and EMS, says they're not, he quotes, I think Maya Angelou says the person isn't going to remember what you say to them. They're going to remember how you made them feel. They're going to remember that you came from the heart. There's a famous Mr. Rogers quote where he said when he was a boy, his mom and he were watching a disaster on television that was occurring. And his mom said he was really anxious. And his mom said, whenever something bad happens like this, remember to look for the helpers. There will always be helpers, right? And that's been my experience is that you're not trying to fix everything in their life. So you have to remove that expectation from yourself as a mental health practitioner. What you're trying to do is just be there as a presence, a caring presence, to let them know there are people in the world who are there for them and do your best to help them just get on their feet in that moment. It's usually practical things that do that, but it's also the who you are as a person in your heart and that you're there to care and be of assistance in whatever way works best for them. So I would say a big part of the stress for providers is to find ways to reduce your expectations about what you can accomplish and just remember that if you weren't there, it wouldn't be as th they wouldn't be having the support that you're there to provide. So that's an important thing.
Such a helpful perspective to remember. I wish I had you 15 years ago to tell me that then.
But now you can play this podcast over and over again if you ever go into work like that. And I do. I feel like disaster mental health is just different. It's just a little different. Like we can't foist these, what we know in these other contexts don't necessarily work. And I think it's important to reiterate that. I imagine, or I don't imagine. I know this is a part of stress first aid. Doing this work is tough, right? And if you are kind of responding and doing stress first aid, that we are still susceptible to all the stressors going around that everybody else is. So, another piece of this that if we could just touch on briefly, and again, I agree, Karim, we could have done like four podcasts. But what about this part of it that's about self and coworker support, and kind of taking care of that piece too, given the demands of what you're doing?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question. So one of the reasons why we make different versions of this model is, the elements are universal, but what you'll see in one culture like military is that what makes them feel unsafe is very different than what makes a healthcare worker feel unsafe. And what I've seen a lot with helping professionals over the years is that sometimes what makes them feel unsafe is themselves. They're their own worst enemy, right? They have a hard time setting boundaries. So they don't feel safe from demands because it's hard for them to be assertive and know when to say no and be self-protective. People who are in any type of job where they're serving others, to me, are like gold. They're really, really important, and we have to preserve them because they're not out for themselves. They're here to help others. So, a big part of the model when we adapt it for different groups is we have supplements. Like there's an empathy and listening skills supplement that includes modules on setting boundaries. I've also recently just been thinking through, there's some really nice people online who have short little videos about, how to have conversations that are difficult, how to set boundaries. And I think they're just simple skills that people have to practice, and they're not used to it because all they really want to do is help others. So I would say that keeping that in mind, knowing that it's hard for you, reaching out to talk with others, other colleagues, other people who may have similar jobs who also struggle with these things can be a really important step. I would also suggest that during COVID, one of the first things I always do when there's any kind of universal kind of stressor that's occurring is I'll go online to see what are other people saying. What are other people saying is helpful. And I was reading some of the articles and the fact sheets that different agencies were putting out, and it occurred to me that the value of the stress continuum for me is that now when I look at advice, I kind of categorize it in a stress continuum. A lot of the advice that was being published during COVID for me would fit in the yellow zone of stress. So I even, you know me, I like to include humor, but one of the memes that I put in my slideshow is that, placing your finger on your forehead will help you deal with stress, right? And then underneath it is a picture of it, the dolls where the head's kind of smushed in because that's what the person was trying to do to their own forehead. When you're in the yellow zone of stress, yes, getting over it and getting back out there and overcoming your fears is probably good advice for a lot of people. But when you're in the orange zone or the red zone, that either is not enough or it's actually counterproductive. It's similar to that analogy of having a strained muscle where you go to physical therapy and stretch and work versus a broken bone where you have to put it in a cast, right? So thinking in terms of this continuum for me has been really helpful too. Like you may have to do different things when you're in different zones of stress. And there's no shame in that. If you're in the orange or red, you may need to have different types of support and take care of yourself differently than when you're in the yellow zone. Most of us will suffer through the yellow zone for years. It's what I did until I was sitting in a park one day, and the first thing that came into my head was, I wonder how many of these kids are being abused. And it was like a light bulb moment where I was like, I might need to like deal with my stress
Oh,
and my
gosh.
anxiety. And it made me realize that at that point in my life, I had gone from wanting kids to not wanting kids. I was
Wow.
young and I wasn't probably getting enough supervision. So it was just a moment for me where I realized I'm kind of in a different level here. I probably need a break, or I need to get some help. So I think everyone can think in those terms of thinking through like what's the right kind of support for different levels of stress that you're in.
Listening to the again, the evolution of this model really speaks to how thoughtful it is and how versatile it is. And I can imagine that many of our listeners are interested and may recognize that there's room for them to offer this to people that they work with. So to move into our actionable intel portion of the episode, I wonder what advice do you have? What resources would you recommend for listeners who may be interested in learning more and considering offering stress first aid to folks that they work with?
Well, I would suggest that there's probably different levels of how you could use it. Number one would be just to remember the five elements. You know, listen to the podcast, jot down the five elements, and start using them in your life, right? So I remember once I was walking into the house. I'm one of those people that likes to carry all of my grocery bags at once, right? Doesn't want to have to go back to the car.
I can
So I'm
see you doing
stumbling.
it. Yeah. It is the
Yes.
only way. It
Holding,
is the
holding
only
all my
way.
bags. It is. So I'm far, things are dropping. I'm trying to get my keys, and my little 6-year-old son is behind me. And I hear him say in this little voice, "Just think about the good things, Mom. Just think about the good things." And I'm like, okay, my work with you is done, right? So you can take the elements and apply them immediately in your life, depending on how you want to. You can start thinking through, are there ways that I'm unsafe? If so, why? How can I do something about that? Do I have a good set of skills that I have mastered about calming myself? Am I using them? Because it's not about whether you have the skills, whether you're like putting them in your schedule. And the same with your friends, you know, like, am I cultivating friendships? Am I like putting those in my schedule, especially with my friends I feel I'm the most comfortable with and I can say whatever I want to with them. And so you can go through, you know, what skills do I need and how can I build hope and meaning and faith and so that's one level. Another level is going to our website. Like I said, now you can just Google National Center for
We'll link
PTSD.
it in the show notes.
Yeah, you can link it. And a lot of materials are there. There's, you know, links to webinars. There's, as I said, manuals, workbooks, slide sets, things like that. So that'd be another level. You can also on the National Center reach out if you want a trainer. We can, you know, provide trainings. So that would be probably what I would recommend at this point.
Just as a recap on that, I'm feeling like the first point of take those and implement them in your own life. I feel like I got a shot of connectedness just in this podcast
Me
because I
too.
got to be with two women that I respect and just love being near. So I'm checking that box for today. But
Yeah.
how can you apply the five elements to your personal life? You know, we've got those training resources on the NCPTSD website, and it's really robust, lots of fantastic resources. I'm just going to also say CDP. Luckily for us, Patricia has helped create some resources on our end too. So we have an older but it's still a goodie webinar recording that we'll link in the show notes, and then some of those like short materials that we put together for providers in times of war was the under the context of that. But we, did a nice job of kind of talking about each of those. So, check them out. Make sure you get more information. I am so grateful that we finally were able to identify
Yes.
a good time to sit down and hear more about this. I never get enough time with you. I never get enough, listening to you, and I could have you back and back again. But thank you for taking the time and the energy to be with us today,
Yeah.
and sharing all this rich information.
Thank you, too.
Selfishly, this is the end of my work day, and this was kind of the perfect way to wrap it up. I feel like I'm moving into the green zone to wrap up my day. So thank you for the conversation.
Thank you too. It's been wonderful to be with you as well.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for listening in, listeners. We hope that you join us again next time, and we look forward to future episodes. So thanks again, and see you next time.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
Please feel free to subscribe, like, and share.
Until next time.